This week on A to Z Running, we take a look at the physics of wind to consider why it does what it does to runners and what we might want to do about that.
We also answer a listener question about marathon training.
In the world of running, track action continues with more records.
Any guesses how fast a 76-year-old can run a marathon? We've got the scoop from London.
And in recent headlines, NIL deals continue and a particular high schooler caught our attention.
All this and more on A to Z Running. Welcome back to A to Z Running, where we help runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching services. I'm Andy.
And I am Zach. And just a reminder that you can learn everything about our services and everything else we do at A2ZRunning.com. If you look for the word coaching, you'll find everything you need to know there. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Spotify, because it makes us feel all warm and fuzzy when people follow us on those things.
Well, we really like the connection. That's what gives us the warm fuzzies.
Well, so don't worry about following us, but comment on the stuff, because that's the real connection.
The conversations.
And what we like to see most.
Speaking of conversations, I've had quite a few of them with new runners recently. More so than ever, I think. I've had conversations with new runners. And I was really quite, challenged by this comment that one of the new runners made, and I loved it because it was a different perspective. It was refreshing because it was like outside of the normal running jargon. And this new runner was saying how she was practicing her running.
Huh.
And normally runners will say that they're training, but rarely post high school do people say that they're practicing running.
I don't think high schoolers say that either.
But they go to practice.
Well, they do.
I don't know if
true.
They say that they're practicing running, though. But I loved that because I started thinking about it. I'm like, yes, we are. We're practicing running. And I think that that really does help us put some of the more proper frameworks on it. Because as we're running, especially those of us who are coming back from injury, I'm speaking with us because I am currently coming back from injury. If I'm not running properly as I'm running, I'm practicing poor form or I'm practicing poor habits and I'm not doing a good job practicing my running.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. And there's something to the mindset difference when it's like, I'm practicing something today and what am I practicing today? And how should I be practicing that so I do so well? It's reminiscent of, pardon my occasional crossovers into the education sphere, but there's a concept which is not at all restricted to education, but they talk about it a lot in education, about what they call expert practice. And that's just simply the idea of isolating with specificity a particular skill that you would like to practice, and then doing so both in a quality manner and with enough feedback to assure that quality manner.
Hmm.
And as a runner, we rarely ever do running practice expertly, just by the very nature of the thing. We're just out running, not with hardly any, if any at all, feedback, except for what our watch tells us, which we've talked about in the past. That's bad feedback. That's not the kind of feedback we're talking about. But, you know, do we ever like get information about whether the thing we're doing is quality and the way we should be doing it and such, and that it's just reminiscent of, you know, there's a lot to it. It's not just going out for a run and trying to get fitter. It's like, how do I make myself a better runner? How do I move better? How do I, all the things. In fact, that's actually something Andy's going to address with our listener question today, because when you ask us about something like marathon training, you're going to get more than you bargained for.
More of a response, that's for sure.
So speaking of exciting things, we often like to shout out our A to Z runners. And we're bumping that to the intro because we want to honor people. And what a better way to do so except right away. And so here we go. Always excited to be able to share with you when people are doing great things. And among them are the following. Mm-hmm. Starting with Marjorie, ran the Eugene Marathon and said it was like beautiful and awesome. And that's pretty cool.
Congratulations.
Eugene, that's pretty awesome.
I would love to hear more about that. That sounds like a really cool destination spot. Kate ran a half marathon and did it very strongly. In fact, the first part was a little bumpy, but then towards the end, she was able to actually pick it up a negative split, which is what we love to hear. And then Michelle, she had done actually a bike race.
Oh, yeah. So, just running.
No, not just running. She is a multi-talented athlete. And then Sarah also ran a half marathon and had a really strong day too, despite not ideal conditions and not feeling awesome. But she's able to hang in super strong and have a great result despite some challenges.
Congrats. Way to go.
Yes.
And to everybody else out there doing the stuff and running the things, congrats and way to go. And this is kind of like racing season. We always talk about this. There's essentially two racing seasons in the world, really. I mean, this is not specific to regions of the world, but for road running, there's like these two times of the year when it's all happening. April, May is one, and then October, November is the other. Not to say there aren't races all over the calendar, but those are like the most thick racing seasons when everyone seems to be doing something somewhere. So we're going to be excited to be sharing a lot of those results with you here in the coming couple of weeks, and it's loads of fun. But at the moment, we're now ready to get on to the first segment. Let's start by answering your questions. Be sure to submit your questions to us so that you can finally have someone answer them correctly.
Oh, goodness.
I mean,
eye rolls.
Because we like to answer your question. No, because we like to interact with you. And this is the best way for our content to match your ideas, needs, thoughts, and insights. Share your questions by sending an email to questions@a2zrunning.com. Email us via questions@a2zrunning.com.
An anonymous listener asked about our advice for marathon training.
Is anonymous listener the same kind of thing as anonymous participant in races?
I don't know.
Are you the same person?
She's ever been an anonymous participant. I'm not sure. But this was a really fun question to lay out. It's been a few years since Anonymous has run a marathon and really wants to give it a strong effort. And so she was asking for advice.
What do I do?
Mm-hmm. So I gave her 5 ingredients for marathon training.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
You laid it all out.
Yeah, I did. So I'm going to give you them real quick, and then I'll talk about each one. Go the distance. Move properly. Sustain your effort. Be mentally strong. Gain adaptations and stay healthy.
Oh, you phrased them. You got like captions and stuff.
I do. Great. I do. Okay, so we're going to start with the first. Go the distance. You need musculoskeletal resilience to go the distance. Long runs are a priority. However, we do need to build volume slowly and at a low effort and have the cumulative volume also be serving you. So we do suggest that people in marathon training have a medium long run. When you're healthy and you're ready for marathon training, doing a medium long run during the week and then a long run on the weekend.
Yeah, the fundamental thing that you have to be able to do to run a race is to be able to run that race. So that's it. That's the thing. What does it take to get to that point? We do, by the way, field the question on a regular basis from our own athletes as well as others of my long run isn't as long as I feel like it should be. Should I run longer? And our first response to that is always a question, and it is, how do you feel running the current distance of long run? And whenever someone comes back and says, well, it's tough, but I'm getting through it, then we say, no, you shouldn't be running longer because it's already a tough stimulus. It's already an adaptation of some sort. It's already challenging your musculoskeletal system. And so this is the point where Andy said cumulative volume matters, long runs matter. You do need to be able to run an individual run long. But in terms of physiological adaptation, the cumulative value of the workload achieves the same end ultimately as a single long run. For just this part. Now, this is not the only ingredient.
Right.
So we'll get to one of the other things. But my point being, if your body is not ready for, say, a 20-mile run, you're stuck at 15 miles, and you say to yourself, but I have to run a marathon, I've got to go out and run 20 miles. If your body's not ready for it, you're only going to do yourself harm. Not only will it not be good, it will harm you in your progress. So you stay where you can handle. you level up incrementally in terms of these volume loads. Long runs are very important, but the balance of volume across a week, for instance, achieves the same end in terms of a musculoskeletal adaptation. So you're not losing something if you say, well, I'm running 10 hours a week, but I can't get my long run more than 2 to 2.5 hours. It's like, yeah, but you're running 10 hours a week. You're doing plenty. Don't worry about it. But we'll keep working on it if you can get a little more when you're able to get a little more.
Yeah. And those medium long runs are usually like pretty long, 90 minutes to 2 hours. So yeah. Those ones also contribute to the overall load of the week, as Zach was mentioning. The second thing is you need to activate properly to get the right wiring. So this is really important, as I was mentioning in the intro, if we're practicing running wrong, that is going to lead to injury and also not getting the strength and the power from our body that can serve us moving the momentum forward.
Right. It's amazing to me that we talk so much about, like, in skill sports, how important the, like, micro movements are. Like, you've got, you know, adult golfers who, by the way, I just have to say, the vast majority of adults who golf, the actual result of that golfing is 100% inconsequential. It does not matter whether what? That person scores better or worse or wins or doesn't win. Meaning, like, it's pride, right? I just want to. I want to be able to. And that's great. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. But I'm saying it's inconsequential. And yet,
I don't get it.
Many adult golfers spend serious money on golf swing coaching, like to do the thing, the motion better. Runners.
Well, isn't the point for any recreational sport?
Runners don't spend a dime on someone helping me be a better moving runner. That's the point.
Oh.
Isn't it fascinating? And so Andy's point here is that it's very important for us to be able to move well because it makes such a big difference. And you can look at study after study of like the effect in terms of running economy and efficiency just by improving some kind of movement efficiency. We should do that more.
Mm-hmm. So what ways help us rewire or wire to move more properly? We do core, functional strength, and we do the pre-run routine, which we have. So feel free to reach out to us for that.
Yeah, just go to atozrunning.com/free.
Mm-hmm.
Currently is available.
And we send you the lunge matrix and precision drills. And those things will help you fire properly and get your body ready in all the planes of motion.
Mm-hmm.
And fartleks and other neuromuscular work within your training schedule is going to help with good firing too. That's super important as well, in addition to your pre-run stuff. But I'd have to say the pre-run stuff, if you're coming from injury, again, I keep bringing it back to my experience. I apologize, but that's what I'm in right now. When you are beginning to build again after long times off, especially, it is very important to do the core functional strength and pre-run routine before doing the neuromuscular running work.
Right on.
Next thing is you need to be able to sustain your effort. So you need high aerobic fitness to sustain your effort.
So like you got to be able to go the distance and you got to be able to go the distance within a range of tolerance. Of
your right. Because remember, we are talking to someone who runs regularly and has done marathons and she wants to perform well. Mm-hmm. So this component is especially important because she wants to be able to run a fast marathon and qualify for Boston. And so at this point, we're going to be needing to get to 60-70% max effort on a regular basis.
Yeah, what we're fundamentally doing when we break apart musculoskeletal and energy system factors is we're suggesting that ultimately you need both of them in tandem, in combination to run for any amount of distance, certainly. But the longer the distance, the more, you know, you can't get away with having a weak structure for 26 miles like you might be able to for 3 miles. But they go hand in hand at all times. And so where your musculoskeletal system is stronger, then your muscles require less oxygen to perform an action. And yet, at the same time, where your energy system is more efficient at transporting oxygen, then it can fuel things at a better degree, higher level, at higher amounts of strain. And so that's where you talk about, you know, long periods of running, but also I want to do it at a high effort. Like I want to try to see if I can better pass performance, all that kind of stuff.
Our suggestion is doing this in periodization. So starting by building your base, that's what people often will use that term, building your base first, doing these more low effort, low aerobic runs. And then after you're able to run healthily and safely at a good volume, it's then that you introduce more effort. And that's what we call steady runs, which is the 60 to 70%.
That's a Lydiardism as well. And so it's as old as modern training is old. The idea of being running at a higher percent of your maximum aerobic potential is better for your energy system in terms of development. But you can't do it every single day all the time. And so we find a balance of some days you're harder, some days you're easier. One of the most interesting things to us is when an athlete will say, you know, the thought didn't occur to me of the importance of varying effort. Like I just run every day about the same. And it's like, well, that's fine, but it could be better. And mm-hmm. the easiest way to make it better in that situation is start by having some days harder, some days easier. And it's not a hard thing to do. It doesn't have to be some perfect formula either. If you're feeling a little bit better one day, go harder that day. And then if you're not feeling a little bit better another day, don't go harder and try again another time. Mm-hmm. So
the next thing, in order to run a good marathon, you need to be mentally strong in that marathon. So you need to grow your focus and train your self-talk. We have to purposely plan our self-talk and practice it on challenging runs. A lot of people kind of like poo-poo this, but it is extremely important in the marathon distance, especially. That 26.2 miles is going to be difficult for anyone who is trying to find their potential in the distance. So practice this in training. You've heard us say this, but doing a couple harder efforts solo with no earphones to develop this focus, and also memorizing some things that you want to have as part of your game plan for race day. These can be mantras, things you say to yourself. Remember, second person is more helpful. So talking to yourself like a coach, you are strong, you are capable. You might want to memorize prayers or songs or quotes that inspire you so you can access that when your mind is tired, because believe me, when you are fatigued, your brain does not work as well. And so if you don't have something ready and in the wings to help you through it, it's so hard to stay positive and to stay mentally tough.
Yeah, we were talking recently about Drs. Lohr and Olson's Wise Decisions book. And one of the constant refrains of the book is this idea of like, we are telling ourselves a story about ourselves and the world. And we encountered this idea again just recently. And so the reason why this popped in my head is it's like, this just keeps coming up surrounding us in all the different spheres of life. And the most recent one in particular was in a session. It was a class about parenting and shame and how the things that are within ourselves affect how we parent our kids, which of course is relevant for us because we're parents. But also the point being, it has again a lot to do with what we're telling ourselves about that feeling inside or that perception of a situation. And it just continues to go back to this constant sense of we are telling ourselves something that is guaranteed, it's happening. And most of the time our self-talk is incidental, it's reactionary to our circumstances. And so you can already anticipate a moment in a marathon when you're going to be miserable and you're not going to want to finish. And if you already know that's going to happen, it's a good idea to spend some time ahead of time preparing yourself for how you're going to talk yourself through that and continue on. So Andy said, you know, not listening to things. The earbuds are just a curse for mental strength and fortitude in runners. Because while it's very nice to be able to listen to all sorts of different things, music, podcasts like this one, or audiobooks or whatever, you know, the stuff we like to listen to, it's wonderful because we have this time, this baked in time to just kind of like chill and relax, and that's great. But it also means that we're not nearly as good at the grind when it comes to things like race day. Now, again, that may or may not be of consequence. In fact, I've talked with plenty of runners who also have the earbuds in on race day and are listening to this stuff then too, which I think, you know, is probably you're losing some aspect of the experience, but I also understand how it can be helpful too. Mm-hmm. And so what it comes down to in our minds is it's still better for us to have greater mental fortitude, resilience. And the best way to exercise that is to practice it in context. And so Andy said harder efforts, but also like long runs, long, easy runs that just feel really boring. You know, it's like, oh man, I'm going to be running for 2.5 hours by myself today. Don't have my friends. And so I'm going to put in the earbuds and listen to something. And the thought is, you know, that's a great opportunity to practice in an inconsequential time, because being really bored is maybe not ideal, but it's not going to harm me to be bored for a couple hours on my run. So my point is there's something there to consider. As Andy notes, it's imperative to be stronger mentally, to have that fortitude. Ways of going about developing that, there's a lot of them, but we encourage it.
Yeah, and this doesn't have to be all the time, but doing it on a regular basis, because just like training, you don't want to go weeks without practicing it. So make sure that you're having those times where you're focusing and you're telling yourself positive things. And again, putting in your arsenal, memorized things that you can easily retrieve when you are fatigued, extremely fatigued and vulnerable.
Right on.
Last one that I have on here, of course, that's not everything to marathon training, but last one we'll discuss today is gaining adaptations and staying healthy. So you need to recover well in order to gain adaptations and stay healthy. Yeah. These are things that you probably tell other people to do, but it's so hard to do yourself. So a lot of you guys know this, but you just need a little reminder, because we all need these reminders. This is eating a good meal as soon as you're able to after a run. This is prioritizing sleep, mobilizing your joints, breaking up muscle adhesions by like rolling, scraping, massage. And I think that this is probably the hardest one, being able to jog or take the day off if the body isn't recovered. Because again, that's why I added the gain adaptations, because you can do all this work. This is the tragedy I see so many people run into, is that they work so hard and they keep breaking down their body, and they're not rebuilding to get the benefit from their hard work. Mm-hmm. And that's tragic to me, when people work so hard and they don't get the gains.
That's right. Very unfortunate. So what it amounts to is, if you do all of those things, anonymous person, you're gonna be great. You're gonna run everything, hopes and dreams, all coming true. It's gonna be wonderful. But you have to do them all perfectly.
But all of this is really just our framework for marathon training. And I say our framework, meaning from the wise sources we've studied in order to have good marathon training. But it is something that can, as Zach said, like he was being funny and sarcastic, but you can't do it perfectly. And that's part of rolling with this and staying healthy. And we're not talking about just staying healthy with your body, but your mind and your spirit too. So it's all about thriving. We think a thriving runner is going to be able to perform at their best.
And then just make sure when it comes to race day that you execute well, because many a good runner has botched a great opportunity by executing a poor race plan. Don't do that. Got it?
Good. I don't think it's helpful to say, don't do that.
It is helpful. You need to know what to do and what not to do.
I guess. Well, that was a great question. We appreciate having these kinds of conversations. We have resources on our website. You can have follow-up questions. Anybody listening who has a follow-up question, we'd love to answer it.
That's exactly what we do. So send your questions to questions@A2ZRunning.com. With that, let's get on to another something helpful. We are going to take a hard pivot here we've been talking about mindset a lot lately, only because it's a great topic and we've been stumbling upon some great material on the topic lately. But we wanted to spend a moment here just for this week on physics.
Ooh.
Everybody loves physics. Science. Actually, though, as it were, physics is one of the most fascinating topics of study for me academically, because it makes everything make more sense about, like, interactions with the forces around us and stuff. And it's just loads of fun as an athlete to understand, you know, for example, the whole ground pounding thing when you're running, right? What's the actual amount of weight downward forces when we run? And it's, you know, obviously it's like 2 to 4 times. What is it? 2 to 4 times your body weight. I don't know exactly what the number is, but the point is that's really interesting, right? And then it explains so many more things when you start to look into the details. Well, this topic in terms of physics is one that has been coming up a fair bit lately, just in casual conversation. And also it's just been windy a lot lately, I feel like, where I've been running and when I've been running. And everyone seems to be commenting to that same extent of the people around where we live. So I'm thinking, all right, wind is on my mind. I'd love to get a little bit more specific about what is actually happening in terms of wind and the costs and benefits, and get a clear sense on not only why it's awful when we're running into wind, which we already all know, but what that actually really means in terms of performance and training as well. And so we're going to talk about that.
And we're also going to talk about tailwind.
Yes, because wind is not just in your face. Although, if you're anything like me, it doesn't matter where you're running and which direction you turn, the wind seems to always end up blowing in your face. Have you noticed that, Andy? Does that happen to you too?
Yeah.
It's inexplicable, but it's true.
Weird. I don't know. But sometimes I think it's because the crosswind feels like a headwind. Sometimes.
I don't know. I can tell you, though, I was doing my long run only a few days ago, and I was running one direction, let's call it north, and the wind was directly in my face, like howling wind, very strong wind. And I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to run my whole run this direction. As a matter of fact, I actually planned an east-west route because I knew the wind was fairly strong in one direction because I was outside earlier. And that was just simply a waste of time to plan that route because I turned left, which means west. Okay, like due north and then due west, because I'm in like country roads where they're all just squares. And the north direction was wind in my face. The west direction, no change. Headwind as strong as it had been previously. And it's a 25 degree. Wait, is that right? 25. It's a 45 degree. Sorry, I was thinking percent. It's a 25%. It's 45 degree turn. It should not. No, it's a 90 degree turn. I'm struggling here with my degrees because I got stuck on percentages.
He loves
in my
to
head.
Study it yet.
A 90 degree turn should be different in wind, and it wasn't. But here's where it gets even better. And then maybe 30 minutes later, I turned south. And you know where that wind was when I turned south? In my face, just as strong as it had been when I was going north. Someone explain that to me. Well,
that's not what we're talking about right now. He's just
but
got
that's
a chip
why
on his shoulder.
It's been on my mind because things like that happen. And this is the point. We know that wind has an effect on results. You can look at something like the London Marathon this year. Everyone kept talking about all the elite runners kept talking about how windy it was. Well, times were on the whole slower than you would have expected for a number of people. And the casualties in the men's race were even more extravagant, where a serious percentage of the pro runners actually just dropped out, didn't even finish the race. That speaks to something. But then you compare it to like the Boston Marathon years ago when Ryan Hall ran the fastest, the national best. It's not the record because Boston's not a records legal course, but he ran under 2:05 in the marathon. The only American who's ever done that. And the talk was, it was the tailwind. That was the only reason. When Boston's course has a tailwind, it's pretty seriously helpful because it's basically at your back the whole time. And so wind hurts you, wind helps you. The question we want to answer here is, does it help or hurt more than the other? And how do we know that? Because in fact, there's a right answer to that. Anything else to add before we get into it?
I think I have some things to say later.
Yeah,
so
okay,
you can continue on.
So what it amounts to is headwinds are bad. And we've got a number of studies we've looked at here. We also found an article specifically published on Runners Connect that kind of brings together a lot of the studies that have been conducted on the topic. So it was just a helpful way to see a synthesis there. So if you're interested in that, just look for Runners Connect, and they've got a good article here. But what it comes down to is that you can measure very specifically. The physics behind this are quite clear and easy to replicate, and it's a little disheartening. And so, oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if we can answer this here, but there are some athletes who do better in the wind than others, and I'd love to know why that is. And I have a couple tips at the end for running into headwinds.
Because they're more triangularly shaped. That's why.
No, that's not it.
No? Okay. Mm-mm.
You can continue on with the science.
All right. So headwinds. We're going to break these apart separately. Headwind and tailwind. The physics on wind forces on objects are quite clear. And as you might guess, this kind of topic has, you know, been extensively studied because of things like air travel and space travel and stuff. And so, like, the idea of what does air resistance do to a moving object?
Or no air resistance in space.
Or whatever the case may be, yes. But what does air resistance do to a moving object? Like a person running? It's pretty straightforward. And here's the tragedy. Increased force pushing against a moving object has an exponential cost. That's right. Exponential. Which means every time, for instance, if the increased wind speed doubles, then the cost of that air resistance quadruples. Because the double is squared. So by the numbers, it's bad. that's the simple point. The physics are really bad. So that also then applies if your speed increases, the cost of the increased air resistance is exponential as well. And so here's what we think about. From the study side of things, they put a person on a treadmill, put them in a wind tunnel, and say, okay, at this amount of wind, what's the VO2 max oxygen consumption? And then increase the wind by this amount, what is it? And yes, when they doubled the wind, it was 4 times the oxygen consumption, give or take a little bit, slight margins of error, but it's very consistent. So that means that it takes a lot of energy to run into a headwind. And it takes even more energy to run into a headwind the faster you try to run. Faster, not like relative to your effort. So you think about this for a second. Why does this happen? Like in layman's terms. Okay, you have, let's say, no wind whatsoever, and you're running 5 miles an hour. Then you have 5 miles an hour worth of air resistance, right? Because the wind isn't moving yet. So if I increase the wind to 5 miles an hour headwind, now I have the wind coming at me and my forces moving against it. Both forces is why it's an exponential increase in
cost. Makes sense.
Yes. Which also means then that you have to consider whether the tailwind side of things has a similar or different effect. Before we do.
Yes. Interrupting this great physics talk for some practical tips for running in a headwind.
No, we're going to get to that.
Oh.
That's at the end.
Okay.
Yes.
I'll wait.
That's in the plan. That's in the plan. So, because it ties to the physics as well, in terms of, anyway, we'll get to that. Okay, so if that's the case, headwind is really bad, then tailwind, now, you use the same example. If you're running 5 miles an hour and there's no wind, it's still, then that basically amounts to a kind of headwind still, because you have air resistance. So now let's say you have a 5 mile an hour tailwind. Well, then that's net neutral, right? Because the tailwind is canceling out the air resistance that you receive by running into it. So if 5 miles an hour is blowing behind you, then it's no change in energy cost from zero. If 5 miles an hour is blowing into you, then it's double the energy cost. And so you see now that the tailwind is basically providing half
yep,
of the headwind's energy differential. I'm using all sorts of words that are not really technically the right words here, but you get the point.
I'm understanding it.
Yes. So when we start to talk about things like tailwinds and headwinds, the reality is if there's wind, and you're not running the same direction the whole time, like Boston Marathon course, where you could benefit from a tailwind the whole race. Otherwise, assuming all things equal in terms of directions that you're running, wind is always bad. It's always worse for you to have wind than not wind, because if there's any amount of headwind, the tailwind does not make up for it. Unless it's seriously stronger, which would be a really strange day every time you turn and the tailwind is way stronger than the headwind. Not my experience.
But if there's wind in the forecast, do not fear. Everyone is experiencing that wind. How you handle it, though, could be to your advantage. On to the good news.
Yes. I guess one more thing I wanted to say before we get on to the good news is that they have tried to pinpoint the exact, like, if you increase the wind by certain miles per hour and you're running at another certain miles per hour, what is the seconds per mile change?
Oh, I've seen that.
Yeah. And it's actually, the studies have demonstrated enough consistency that it's a reliable kind of predictor. And it's awful. I'm not going to try to give you the numbers because it depends on all these variables, and we could give you 17 different situations. But the point is you could say, it's definitely the case that, you know, a tailwind might give you about 5 seconds per mile advantage, but the headwind's going to give you 10 seconds per mile disadvantage in that situation. And they'll calculate things like if a 330 marathoner is running into a headwind of X, and I can't remember what the one example was, it's going to add 5 seconds per mile cost. And that person should anticipate a 330 marathon effort into a consistent headwind would result in a 345 marathon result for the same effort, right? Because your speed is decreasing. You're not changing your, in this case, you're not giving more effort. You're giving the same effort, which means it's going to slow you down.
Hence our argument to run by effort.
That brings us to the good news. That's why we wanted to transition from that point to the good news, because there are a few things that we have to consider then as runners that will allow for this not just being like a tragic fact of the thing. And one is, in the same studies, they also wanted to find out, not every single one of the studies did the same thing with this, but the wind tunnel studies, for example, wanted to find out what happens to that energy cost if there's a ton of wind and there's a human-sized object in front of you blocking the wind. Yes, drafting. You knew we were going to talk about it because that's the only option you have when you're running a race to help with the wind. Otherwise, we're all experiencing it. And the answer is somewhere in the vicinity of 80% reduction in the energy cost. So it's still, the wind is still going to have a negative effect, even if you're drafting behind somebody else. But it's way less. So now you and the person in front of you, you're running a different race. And that's something important to know. Now, we've been talking about this with running. The cycling industry has mastered this concept. They've studied this way more extensively because they need to, because it makes way more of a difference when you're on wheels than when you're on foot. And so, as it were, that's where you get into like the whole, there's like mathematical approaches to where you want to be in a cycling race in terms of in the draft pack and like slightly off the side of the leader or like three people behind, like all that kind of stuff. They've got it like down to a science and it's just hilarious. And of course there's one best position, you know, one optimal position, but only one person can be there. And the reality is unless you get lucky, you're not going to be that person. Well, for running, it's not quite as elaborate because it doesn't make quite as much of a difference, but they even found when they did the Nike Breaking 2 project with Kipchoge, they tried to study a number of elements within drafting and wind resistance, and they actually created, and this was going to be obvious from the very beginning, everyone knew this was going to be the case, but what's the best shape of an object of runners in front of you to reduce wind resistance that you experience? And they actually did that. They studied that, and they found, of course, it's a wedge, some kind of slightly triangular diamond-shaped thing, and then if they shaped the pacers in front of Kipchoge, and well, it wasn't just him by himself that time. Remember, there were three of them together trying for it that time. And the other project was solo. That was different. So anyway, they did that. They actually designed a shape for the pacers to run in.
Like birds fly.
Yeah, is no surprise. Now, that brings us to then, so what can we do about this? We can certainly run behind somebody, try to draft off of people. That's a great idea, especially if it's the same person the whole time because you know that they're doing way more work. I'm kidding. That's not a nice thing to do. Well, no, it's fine. Go ahead. But there's more.
There is more. So here are some things that you can do on a day with headwind. Zach alluded to it with drafting, but there are other decisions that you can make to help you in that scenario of drafting. So one is, if there are people that you can run with them. And if the pace group is slower than what you would like to go, still go with the slower group. You will be better off than running alone.
Yes, because you're going to cost more energy running alone and you're going to end up running slower. So
right.
The pace group might get you faster, even if it's slower pace than what you want.
It's true. And it's better, even if you have win at the end, to have that energy in the final part of the race to finish strong. It's better mentally. It's going to get you a better performance. So go with a slower pace group if there's no one around you that is going to be running similarly to you. The other thing is, I think what often happens with runners that even increases more their poor performances with headwinds is that they slump their bodies down because they don't like looking up into the wind. And so their head and their shoulders come down and their form isn't as good. On a windy day, I recommend wearing sunglasses, because if you're able to look up and the wind isn't getting in your eyes, making your eyes water as much, you're more likely to keep your eyes up into the wind, which is going to help you. A forward lean, yes, you do still want to do that, and maybe even more than what you normally would do. You might find yourself doing that. But if you are slumped over and your head is looking to the ground, you for sure won't have as good of a race as if you keep your eyes up. So sunglasses. And then another thing is to wear clothing that doesn't catch the wind. So I would recommend wearing like a mesh singlet. There actually was a time that Nike came out with these singlets with holes in them for, do you remember that?
No.
Okay. Galen Rupp had it.
No. He punched the holes in it himself.
Oh, he did? Okay.
Yeah. He did that for a while.
I'm not sure how much of an effect that is, but I would not wear a very large, like wind or not, I guess a wind jacket. But you know, like something that catches the wind, because you're going to have more surface area that is going to be in conflict with that wind.
You ready for this, so, Andy?
Yeah.
You ready for this?
What?
Once upon a time, Team USA's marathon uniform singlet that they gave to the athletes, men and women, was a mesh crop top. Not kidding you.
That was not that long ago.
Yep. Not that long
ago. I remember that. I was like, what is that?
Yeah, no one wore it, so no one knew what it was because no one had ever seen it in the actual competitions.
So breathable fabric, that's all I'm saying. You don't want big things that will catch the wind. And if it's a colder day, you're going to have to make some decisions. So I know that's...
Cold wind is the worst.
Cold wind is rough. You're going to have to make some decisions on that. But I wouldn't recommend things that are really baggy because it's going to catch the wind.
What it comes down to is the wind is an inevitability. You can do some things in the moment, like in a race, especially when you're around other people. Most of us are around someone else and we can kind of clump up into groups. But the fact remains that it's going to be a factor anytime there's wind. And the greater the wind, the more of a factor, of course, it's going to be. And the best thing we can do for ourselves is to be prepared mentally to not have that throw us off our race. And that means, as Andy was saying earlier, practicing running. Practicing running in poor conditions is very important for runners. And we talk about this so often recently, especially when we're talking about treadmills. We're saying a lot of us go on the treadmill when the conditions are poor outside because it's like, I don't want to run in that. And then we just get weak. So when it comes time to race day and it's not perfect in ideal conditions, our mental space can't handle it. Or at least doesn't handle it as well. So don't do that to yourselves. Wind is not going to harm you most of the time. It could actually, but most of the time, the wind you're experiencing is not going to harm you. And it is okay to go out for a training run and knowing it's going to be slower because it's a windy day and I have to do a hard effort. It's not going to be anywhere near what it should be because it's a windy day. And just be okay with that and do it. And better yet, throw your watch away and then you don't even have to know.
I like that.
That's my advice.
Remember, Des Linden attributes a lot of her success to running in harsh conditions.
Yeah.
In Michigan.
She said that a lot.
So she goes out, she gets it done on the hard days, the ugly days, and that has helped her in her mental toughness, hence being Boston Marathon champion in the worst weather.
Says something.
It does.
So now you know that wind is bad, if you didn't before. But more importantly,
I don't like those words that you keep saying that. So I don't know. Because that's, I don't want to repeat that to myself. Wind is bad. I want to think of something like, wind is okay, and here's how I'm going to deal with it. Wind is out of my control.
You, Andy.
Wind is out of my control. It's weather, and this is how I'm going to handle it and have the best day for the conditions.
And in Zach's pessimism, I say to myself, wind is bad, but that's okay. Move on. All right. Speaking of moving on, we have some interesting things to talk about in the world of running. So let's get right to it. Track is in full swing, although it's in full swing sooner than usual. I actually was just hearing them talk about this on one of the,
broadcasts.
And I forget that we're in the month of April. Officially, the professional track season rarely actually starts before like May and really doesn't start until end of May, like June. This year and the last couple only is unique in the sense that the Diamond League circuit has started in April. And that's because they've added more competitions to the circuit.
Also, because we have the Olympics this summer, which is kind of during the time that Diamond League happens.
It does change the timetable. The only difference is in an off year. There's a year, it's the year after the Olympics. It's the year after that. It's the in-between year when there isn't an Olympics or a World Championships in terms of track and field. And that's the only year when the track season is just a regular through the summer season, and it definitely feels shorter. But yeah, we're in full swing, and we've got a few things to talk about. We want to talk about the pro side of it in the Diamond League, but also some crazy collegiate stuff going on too, which maybe is in even more full swing than anything else.
So Zach, second week in China.
Second week in China, Suzhou.
In Suzhou, we had the men's 5,000. These are going to be very brief because they weren't quite as exciting as last week. But Salomon Berega got the win, and that was unsurprising. The news, though, 17-year-old Benam Mihari was second place.
He's 17 years old.
And he was battling Berega. Berega was stronger in the last 200, I would say, of the race and ended up pulling ahead in the last 100. But that 17-year-old gave him a run for his money. Literal money, because it's Diamond League.
Yeah, Ethiopian countryman. Mihari's been on the radar now for a bit. This is not out of left field by any means, but 17 years old, running 12:56. This kid is something crazy. Mm-hmm. So, yes, that's exciting whenever it happens. And you've got Salomon Berega looking like he's in good form, which is always dangerous. He is, as you know, the defending Olympic 10,000-meter champion. Mm-hmm. And he's looking fit and ready to do it again.
Looking fit.
See?
One in a time of 12:55.68. Mihari was 12:56.37, so just over a second after. I don't know where that puts him for his age, but it's got to be up there.
It's good.
It's got to be up there. Sub 13 is great, especially this time of season.
I'm not sure when he turns 18. I don't think it's a U18 scenario because he turns 18 this year.
Okay.
Which is why, if it was, that might be talking records, but I don't believe it is.
Well, it's hard to know because there's not a lot of good, how do I want to put this gently?
The records aren't always accurate?
The records just aren't known by the announcers, and also it's hard to find some of this
And
stuff.
The announcers are terrible. They don't know anything about the athletes.
Oh, stop it.
That's
don't
what
be
she
so
wanted
negative.
To put gently.
Don't be...
Listen. If you watch the NBC coverage of a Diamond League race and then you watch the BBC coverage of a Diamond League race, you will know what we're talking about. They are not even in the same ballpark. NBC, you got to pick up the game. You got to do it. All right. Men's 800.
Men's 800. The only thing I really wanted to note about this event was that Clayton Murphy clawed his way back to fitness and was third place. So I'm excited to see what Clayton Murphy can do. He had a little rough patch for a bit, and he's looking good at the right time, which is not surprising because it's planned. It's not like you know, it's not an accident that he is looking good in an Olympic year.
I mean, he is an Olympic medalist in the 800.
Right.
There aren't that many of them in the United States, but some have said that was a different Clayton Murphy, and I mean, we'll see.
Slimane Mula won in a time of 144.55, so it wasn't like crazy, but that's a respectable time.
Yeah, and part of the dynamic duo of Algerians, Mula and Sajadi, and the two of them are just constantly top three in Diamond Leagues. You're always going to talk about them when you talk about medal potential at the Olympics. And so Mula is looking great, looking strong. That's a good thing.
Brief note about the women's 3,000-meter steeplechase. Beatrice Chepkowicz won dominantly again in a time of 9:07.36. Slower because of the conditions, yeah. But still a very dominant win.
Yeah, Chepkowicz. So she does this all through the Diamond Circuit, and then she doesn't win at the World Championships. And I'm trying to figure out why. My best guess is she really only has one race plan, and that is to run faster than everybody else. But when it comes time at the World Championships for like serious world-class racing, they don't have pacing lights, they don't have pacers, and it's just not quite as easy to pull that kind of a tactic off. And so she tried it last time around and almost won it. She was overtaken late in the race by the one runner who could hang with her. So we'll see. We'll see.
Maybe it's a business decision. Maybe she makes more in Diamond League than she does the World Championships. And so she wants to win Diamond League championships.
True that. Yeah. But either way, she is definitely looking strong yet already this season.
Penn Relays. Men's mile was one of the highlights with Yared Nuguse, previous podcast guest, breaking the meet record that was in existence for half a century.
Now, whose meet record? That's not a Steve Scott record,
no,
right?
No, Tony Waldrop.
Waldrop. Okay, so this record's been around for forever.
Yeah, literally half a century.
That's weird.
So his time, Tony's time, was 3:53.2, and Nuguse ran 3:51.06. taking a solid 2 seconds off for the win and for the record.
He wasn't the only one who broke the record either.
No, he wasn't. Oliver Hoare was also under that time in the 3:51.28, and American Eric Holt in a time of 3:51.46. Don't sleep on Holt. He's always right there.
What was he, fourth at the last World Championships? Or was that the year before that? Holt's dangerous in the event. The tough part is if you're Eric Holt right now and you're 28 years old or so and you're thinking this might be my last legitimate shot at an Olympic qualification, and we have one of the strongest fields of milers in United States history. Probably,
the strongest
field. And it's like you are a 351 miler and by no means does that make you confident that you can make the team yet. Like, it's a possibility, but
Holt is dangerous, though.
We'll see.
He's always in the mix, it seems. I wanted to tell about that record a little bit. Okay, yeah. Nuguse's time also set a Franklin Field record, so that's a stadium that they were running in, besting Irish great Eamon Colgan's time of 3:52.88 from 1979. So these are really old records that they're dropping.
Penn Relays has been around forever, and the Penn Stadium at that. And what's interesting is that over the recent era, it's just kind of become a non-factor. People just aren't really going there to run fast. I would love to know why they did this year. There were a number of stars showing up at Penn Relays, which just never happens, running really fast times. I'm very interested.
The 4x mile records were broken. Collegiate records. The Villanova men's 4x mile team and the Washington women's 4x8 broke their collegiate records. I should have said relay records were broken because there's two different relays. 4x mile team for the men and the Washington women's 4x8 100 meter run. So that was really exciting.
Yep. There was a DMR collegiate record as well that Harvard's women broke by a lot, by like 6 seconds. And so just like lots of great fast running at the college scene, especially on the relay side of things lately.
Yeah. Only thing that I'll note that's interesting, Liam Murphy anchored for his team in a time of 3:54.32 for the mile to
that's
run.
Not bad.
And their team won, ran 1551.91.
Yeah.
Okay.
So notably, for seemingly for forever now, people have been talking about a relay team from a single college breaking 16 minutes because the 4x mile, that's 4 sub-4 miles, right? And there's plenty of schools that have had more than 4 sub-4 milers, but for some reason have never done it.
Perform all at the same time.
Oh yeah, whatever the case may be, have never done it. You can see that the collegiate record being 1603 from 2009, 15 years ago. And so when it comes down to it, it's like someone's got to do this. And then not only did Villanova set the new record, but three teams ran under 16 minutes in this race. So it's like, let's just all do it at the same time. I don't know.
Yeah. And interesting, in the women's 4x8, the Washington women barely got the record, but they did, running 8:17.28, beating out the record of 8:17.45, so just 0.2 seconds. Mm-hmm. Second place would have been Providence, but the anchor like dropped her baton and she didn't seem to notice, and she kept running and finished the race without the baton.
Did you really look like she didn't notice?
That's what the reports say. Oh, and then, man, Duke was third at the time, but of course is bumped up to second.
Wow. That's really unfortunate.
But was way behind. 8:28.37.
Yeah, 11
was
seconds
Duke's
back.
Time. That's significant in 4x8.
Wow. Bummer. I've seen a lot of mishaps in relays, including the one with the World Cross Country Championships where the mixed relay, the guy comes in to hand off to his Ethiopian teammate and he stepped on her shoe and it fell off. And then she spent like 30 seconds trying to put it back on and couldn't get it on and ended up running her whole leg with only one shoe.
Oh my word.
Such a bummer. They still were second, by the way. And there was no way they were catching Kenya anyway, so besides the point. All right, just a quick couple other highlights for the college scene here in the last week or so. It's just things are just happening. Well, I guess these aren't all college. It's just track scene. First, Colin Salmon from NAU. We mentioned he just barely missed the collegiate record in the 1,500 meters. And then he just went and ran 1:45 in an 800. And it's just like this guy. So he has some training partners. One of them is a teammate. The other one is Louis Grijalva, who was at NAU, but now is just running professionally. But Louis Grijalva and the others have said that Colin Salmon's making the Olympics for the U.S. Like,
wow.
He's definitely doing it. And I'm like, how can you say that?
You can't say definitely.
This is the best miler field in the history of the United States, potentially. But Colin Salmon is a factor in that field, and that's part of what makes this field so deep. He's a 3:33 1,500-meter runner who can also run 1:45 in the 800. This is just adding layers and layers. It's really exciting.
It's the drama, and we should all be excited to see it unfold at the Olympic trials. So tell your friends, have watch parties, make track a thing, okay?
That's it.
Let's make track a thing.
Salmon, by the way, at 20 years of age, he's actually a touch older than Cole Hawker was when he made the Tokyo Olympic team and then finished sixth in the finals.
I remember that.
Yeah. So that's the kind of, it happens. It happens is my point. Let's talk about Cooper Tier for a moment, too, speaking of these legendary milers. Cooper Tier won the U.S. championships in 2022 and then just was like off for a bit. Like didn't seem to be quite the same runner. Well, he just ran a personal best 1500 in 3:32. So you got to have him in the conversation. He's already a U.S. champion. He's in the conversation for sure. And now, just adding more and more layers to it. And everyone's like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. I'm reading on the message boards. People are talking about the milers right now in the U.S.
Don't read the message boards.
No, this is a fine kind of topic because it's much more positive. But people are just kept saying like, oh, don't forget about this guy. Don't forget about this guy. And,
right?
And it's like, there's so many.
There's so many.
So all that is to say, my final comment here on the topic, I think I might be more excited for the U.S. Olympic trials 1500 meter this summer than any event I've ever anticipated.
Wow, that's saying a lot.
I'm really interested in seeing how this unfolds.
I mean, because speaking of Hawker, there's Hawker too.
Cole Hawker, Yared Nuguse. Don't forget about Hobbs Kessler. I mean, it's stacked.
Incredibly.
All those
deep
Washington guys who have all run 3:40 or 3:51 or so. Yeah. Yeah.
Oof.
Well, let's
thrilling.
Move on. Let's move on. So let's cross a couple of divides here and stop talking about the youngsters running fast. How about the people who aren't youngsters anymore but are still running fast?
I would argue that that's even more impressive. 76-year-old woman ran a 3:33:27, sorry, at the London Marathon. You've probably been seeing this trending, and her name has come up several times over the last decade. It's Jeannie Rice. She broke her own age group record. It's a world record at the London Marathon, averaging 8:08 per mile pace for that 3:33. And what's really impressive about it is that she already had held the age group record of 75 to 79 from last October in Chicago and took a minute and 5 seconds off of that time. What? So she's older now. You know what I'm saying? Like, she ran faster as she's getting faster. She's getting older. Now, it's not her PR, but like, she's still improving, which is super cool.
And let's not forget that London was this like windy race this year. So she must have been drafting well.
Well, in the interview, she said that it didn't meet her expectations. She was hoping for 3:30.
My goodness, lady. Come on. Take your wins when you get them.
Although I believe she can do it because based on that day, I would say that she likely can do that. With Amazing. London's result, Rice now has won a first place age group award in every marathon major.
What?
Also, at London, she beat all the men as well in that age group. So she was the first finisher between 75 and 79.
Okay. That's it.
Rice is running faster than she did back in 1983. I found out this little fun fact. When she began marathoning, she ran a time of 3:45 back in 83.
Well, she's just a rookie then. Now she's got the experience.
Now she has the experience.
40 years worth.
I loved this quote from her. I train and compete with much younger men, so I forget how old I am. And we never talk about age. We talk about training, racing, and nutrition. I know I am old enough to be their grandmother, but it doesn't matter. My running does the talking. In the 2019 Berlin Marathon, my time was 2 minutes faster than the first place in my age group for the men.
Yeah.
Rice lives by the mantra, never underestimate your ability, and has learned a lot about mental toughness, motivation, and determination through her years of running.
No doubt she has.
Yes.
How cool is that?
Jeannie Rice is inspiring.
You know, the youngsters running fast is fun, but this is way more inspiring to me. That's all I got to say. All right. Well, speaking one last time about the youngsters, we encountered the recent news and thought we would talk about it for a little bit, but also it spurred a little bit more investigation because I was not aware, call me ignorant, but I was not aware that high school has such a developed NIL scene.
I didn't either. This was news to me as well.
So I knew that college for a few years now has been growing and expanding, but high school, it's just as prominent. And what's incredible is how much money high schoolers are making because they're on Instagram and TikTok. Like, that shocks me. And I have something to say about it, but I'm not going to say that yet. First, the thing that spurred this investigation was Addie Ritzenheim. Congrats.
Congrats, Addie.
Congrats, Little Ritz, on your new professional deal with On. And however much money they're paying you to be cool on social media, but also be fast at the same time. That's just got to be so exciting. Addie, if you recall, won the Nike Cross Country Nationals as a sophomore this past fall and has continued on in a stellar track season thus far. And so continues to perform well. But as we are starting to learn, there's a whole lot of factors that go into whether someone is a good candidate for an NIL deal. And you don't know what most of those factors are because they're non-disclosed, but it seems a natural fit that On Running would be interested in Addie Ritzenheim.
And I was saying to many people that it only really makes sense. Like, she is already influencing people to buy On. She's already fielding questions and is looked to by her peers because she's so fast for running in those shoes. She's influencing people to buy shoes. Why not give her a piece of that pie? Because she's doing the work already. She might as well get paid for it.
Now, here's where people start to ask questions. Because these things, these NIL deals, are theoretically based around someone's public appeal, which is predominantly social media. Addie Ritzenheim does not have some crazy social media presence.
She actually just started hers after she won the Gatorade Award, you know, yes. The Athlete of the Year Award.
Yep. So prior to signing this deal with On, she had maybe like 3,000 Instagram followers. I think they said that it doubled after she signed this deal with On. So it's like maybe 5 or 6,000. But whatever the case may be, the deal did not happen because of a strong social media presence. And so that starts to, well, there are other reasons that Addie already has a strong, prominent public appeal. One being her accomplishments. A Nike Cross Nationals champion certainly doesn't hurt. The Gatorade thing didn't hurt anything. But also, you know, running royalty doesn't hurt anything. She's already a household name because her name is a household name. And she's living up to it. And so then it becomes like just that much more so. But also, On has a serious investment in trying to expand its brand currently in the younger audiences because it's a newer brand. It's not as well known. It's not as hip and cool as Nike, right? But also their prominence is currently based in the US market is based around her dad. I mean, it just is. His team, the On Athletics Club, is the central force for expanding people's interest in the company currently in the running scene in the United States. And so it makes sense. It's a logical choice that they would connect with her mm-hmm. directly as well.
To back up, for those of you who are listening that are local to the Grand Rapids area, I know some of you are, both Dathan Ritzenhine and his wife Caitlin Ritzenhine lived in Rockford, Michigan, and were like obviously super famous runners in the area. And Addie did live in Rockford, Michigan for a time. So that there's like that local connection I wanted to mention.
Are you just trying to like own
no,
them right now?
Is no, I'm just trying. Because
they're
like,
mine.
No, I'm not at all. No, I just am like, because a lot of people find news more interesting if it hits closer to home. So okay, for sure. Those of you where this hits closer to home, you can be excited.
And
for
those
the
of you who
family.
Live in Boulder, Colorado can also be excited. Because
yeah, exactly.
You can
and everyone
own
can
them
be excited.
Presently.
Everyone can be excited because this is interesting stuff.
It is interesting stuff. Now, we've been talking a lot about the fast high schoolers this year, and so I started to dig into it. Who actually has NIL deals right now? Like, where's the money? New Balance, by the way, is like the big player in the high school running scene. And they've got the likes of Sadie Englehart, who's been breaking all the middle distance records. They've got Daniel Simmons and Drew Griffith, who between the two of them have won like half of the big titles this year for everything, as well as setting records. And so a number of others also. What got crazy to me is that when you start to look at the NIL valuations for high school athletes, now runners, it's low on the totem pole. As you know, running is just not a mass appeal sport. There are, in fact, high school basketball players who have the highest NIL value of even high school and college.
Wow.
Yes. And so then we're talking about high school basketball players who may be making somewhere in the vicinity of $5 to $8 million. In their
what?
NIL contract.
No.
Yes,
are you sure?
Yes.
That blows my mind.
You don't know for certain because these are non-disclosed agreements.
So these are speculations. These are rumors.
No, they're not exactly. Because what it's based on is we know what people are getting in terms of compensation based on certain kinds of things. And if you compare that against some of the other people. So no, it's not a perfect science. But that's why I said 5 to 8 million. So the point here being, is that a good thing? Is it a good thing for high schoolers to be paid to be athletes, Andy? What's your take?
I have a few different thoughts. I think I can see it from both ways. One way that I view it is if they are garnering attention for a brand or the brand is benefiting from a person's performance who is using a product, that brand is making money on people's.
But that's chicken and egg thing. They're promoting the brand because the brand is paying them. If the brand wasn't paying them, they wouldn't have to promote it.
But they still would be like, so if Addie Ritzenhine is wearing On Athletics and she is winning races, people are, and her, especially her peers are going to be like, what are you wearing? What shoes do you wear? They're going to be automatically looking to her because she's the best.
But then you're saying, so if a person wears Nike shoes because they like them, then Nike should have to pay them.
I'm just saying that it's not, that would not be unfair.
Okay, gotcha.
I'm not saying that, because we do that all the time. All of us are promoting products because we like them or use them.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's wrong if someone is doing, like, you know, who is in the spotlight, who's very influential, is using a product that company pays them money. I do think that it causes a lot of pressure on young athletes, and I think that that might cause some early peaking. So I'm not saying that's going to happen to any of the mentioned athletes. I just think that there could be more pressure that might be difficult for a young person to navigate and make decisions on their long-term well-being. So it's all a balancing act, I'm sure, for parents as they go through this with their children who are superstar athletes. Also, I don't know how it works with paying minors, if this is going into like some sort of fund that matures later. Or
no, they can get paid.
So like a 17-year-old can make $5 million and it's their money to spend however they want to.
17-year-old can go star in a movie and they're going to make money.
But a lot of times that goes into like until they're a certain age. I know there's been a lot of like...
That's with like child actors. Teenagers, it's not quite the same. Okay. It depends on how old they are, but yeah.
I think it's also very difficult for kids to have that much money because that gives them opportunities and distraction that could hurt them.
Ask every celebrity who is a celebrity as a child or teenager ever. And it was a bad thing. Every single one of them. We'll say that. Now... I think this is atrocious. I think it is a terrible, terrible thing. And it is for one simple reason. Because once again, we as a society have decided that the most important thing is your followers on social media. We're going to pay you a ton of money for it. And you're going to do everything you can to get people to want to look at you or see your stuff on social media. And I can tell you right now, nothing good will ever come of that. Period. Not a chance. So for every one of these kids, this is a bad thing. And it's only promoting an interest toward bad ends for everyone who isn't getting it yet. Because now they're starting to say, what can I do to get more people to want to pay attention to me? Nope. I hope we can find a way as a society to reject the notion. I don't think we will, because I think that this is what we all want. And we're going to get it good and hard.
But it is exciting to live in these times where we're seeing such incredible performances and hopeful runners.
Yeah, true.
That are looking really good to represent the United States. It'd be interesting to know what they're doing in other countries with NILs. Mm. I'd like to investigate that further to know globally what we're looking at as far as when youngsters are getting paid. That'd be interesting to know.
True that. We may, in fact, continue investigating the topic further and share with you our findings.
This has been really fun. Thank you all for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.